ありがとう、ミスタルのバット、パーパーのみまけ。どうもありがとう、ミスタルのバット、いつも知りたい。
Somewhere out there, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Our guest tonight, Charles R. Smith. He writes, invisible aircraft, robot planes that hunt and kill used to be the stuff of science fiction. U.S. war planners, faced with a growing shortage of manpower, now turning toward a wide variety of unmanned armed robot planes to fill the gap in firepower. The dangers of the modern battlefield has put unmanned systems at the forefront of warfare in inside war-torn Iraq, for example. Northrop Grumman has finished the first phase of testing its new medium-altitude unmanned aerial vehicle. It's called the UAV. The aircraft is a prototype of the Hunter II drone, which is designed to conduct ground surveillance and act as a long-range communications node. The Hunter, like many unarmed robot planes, is being tested with precision-guided missiles. One such weapon inside Iraq is the current U.S. Army Hunter I drone, armed with a miniature guided munition named Viper Strike. Tests in combat, according to Charles R. Smith, with Viper Strike have led Pentagon planners to seek a better sensor system for the guided bomb. The unmanned Hunter and its latest weapon are expected to be in heavy demand since the Viper Strike's small warhead is well suited for urban operations. Lots to talk about tonight with Charles R. Smith, and believe it or not, a lot of UFO reports may have been coming because of some of these kinds of aircraft which have been flying around in test modes around this country. We'll talk with Charles about that too in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Cyber war columnist Charles R. Smith, one of America's leading experts on cyber technology and its implications for war, terrorism, privacy, and everyday technology, interacts with our lives. He is an exclusive columnist for Newsmax.com as its cyber war expert and is currently president and CEO of Soft War, his own consulting company. Mr. Smith's life sounds like a character in a Tom Clancy novel, and he received a U.S. government top secret clearance as a top-level computer engineer for EDS. There he was assigned to work with the U.S. Army on logistic projects during the Cold War. He currently provides security software for medical information services, hospitals, encryption software for secure email, direct communications, electronic commerce, internet website services, and during the past 10 years, Smith has also become a noted investigative journalist. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Charles, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on board. I appreciate it.
Boy, let me tell you, since you were on with me in October, I think this entire planet has become topsy-turvy. Look what is changing now. And to me, if you connect the dots, Charles, I think we're heading for, and I don't know if it can be stopped, but I think we're headed for a major world crisis. Now, what's your take on all this?
Actually, I'm just still looking at more of the same, some cases piled higher and deeper, but one of the predictions going into the 21st century was that we would be faced with a series of what's been referred to as brushfire wars or conflicts, generally low-level operations, strictly limited, frankly, in a specific belt here on the planet, consisting of the Middle East, Africa, Southeast and Southwest Asia. There are actually a few that are predicting that because of historical analysis, traditional state-to-state warfare is a thing of the past because simply it's too destructive, and most of the major states are avoiding this. And we've based this on the historical evidence coming out of World War II all the way up to today. What I'm seeing essentially is a continuation of what we witnessed during the sessions in the Cold War, proxy wars taking place, not necessarily the superpowers bullying or jockeying with each other, but smaller kind of affairs where individual nation states have a stake. So that's the major area in conflict, and the secondary, of course, has been the rise of what they refer to as transnational terrorism, or what I like to refer to as the Goldfinger syndrome, where we have individuals who have formed terrorist movements, much like the fabled Spectre from James Bond novels.
Okay, and they're financed by whomever, I would guess, right?
Right. And in some cases, they are actually for-profit operations. And once again, having to deal with that is what we know today as terrorism. This is, again, a lower level of warfare where we're actually blurring the traditional lines of law enforcement, intelligence, and then eventually major theater combat operations all into a single area. And what we're really viewing are fairly small and highly skilled teams of fighting units that are employed in these kind of operations. It's a far cry, frankly, from 25 minutes to live, 5,000 thermonuclear bombs poised to be flung halfway across the world on a hair trigger notice from the old Cold War days, but it is dangerous nonetheless, but it is not, you know, the world, the end of the world scenario that we faced in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. So to me, it's not quite as formidable as many like to put it forth as a major conflict. I'm sorry, being a Cold War baby, you know, 8.5-9 million men pole to pole, face to face, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, living inside the Beltway or in working in the Pentagon or as we actually knew it, in the target zone, we knew that in any one moment we might get notification that, you know, you've got 20 minutes and that's it.
Well, I remember my parents telling me years later, because I was born in 1950 and the Korean War period, that, you know, they felt like that's all they did was live during war. My father was in World War II. Then there was the Korean War. You know, shortly thereafter, in terms of the scheme of things, we go into the Vietnam War. It seems like we have been in wars all the time, Charles, at least in my lifetime.
It's the curse of mankind. If you want to go back through history, it's been a continuous affair. There are a lot of competing interests, and some of which appear to require be settled by combat, violence, and force. That's just part of human nature. And, of course, we also have the other side of the coin. There are many major corporations, both based here in the United States and outside the United States, who have invested interest in keeping things violent. To be honest with you, if you look at actual total numbers of deployments and total times being deployed, we've actually deployed more troops farther, faster, and more firepower since 1990 than we had since the end of World War II. The decade of the 90s was literally the deliver the pizza mission was invented, where we had Kosovo, we had Somalia, we I had operations going in Iraq and Sudan and a number of places around the globe where our forces were committed, some cases in non-combat operations, but still just as lethal. So one of the things that I think that we ended up having to face, being the, quote, sole superpower, was also being in a position where our best vested interest was to deploy our forces. Now, of course, there are some cases where I vehemently disagree, like the Kosovo and Yugoslavian operations. That should have been strictly left to the Europeans, mm-hmm. but they didn't want that. They wanted us to come in to settle their affairs, as we have done so many times before.
And even though we have apparently cleaned it up, have the atrocities there now ended? I mean, are they...
Oh, no. They are still ongoing, even at a lower level. And there are a number of NATO and UN and U.S. armed forces that are still following up and keeping sides cornered. And there are unmanned aerial vehicles flying reconnaissance missions trying to make sure that everybody stays nice.
They're all over the place. You know, in his first term, George Bush talked about the axis of evil, citing, of course, Iran, Syria, and North Korea. And if you look in the news just today, we have Iran and Syria kind of forming an alliance here. North Korea has created a problem admitting they have a nuclear weapon, whether they do or not. The fact is they said they did. My prediction, Charles, your take, and then we're going to get into why we have this kind of drone technology and how it's going to be used. I think either we or the Israelis are going to strike Iran pretty darn soon. As a matter of fact, today Israel says they're going to have an atomic bomb in 6 months. Cut that in half, say 3 months, because you can't have much room for a margin of error here. I think something's going to happen there. Syria, I mean, that's an area that's been a trouble spot for a long time. Something I think is going to happen there. North Korea, of course, has the stronger army, and if they do possess a nuclear weapon, you know, this world needs to be careful with them. What do you think is going to happen? How is this going to unfold? Because these are real problem spots.
Well, there's two parts of this. One, this is a proxy war. Keep in mind that North Korea and Iran and Syria have backing from certain major countries like China and Russia. And therefore, that's, if you really want to look at the source of their logistics, their combat operations, or sophisticated materials, that's where we need to focus.
Russia today announcing they're going to sell Syria missiles.
Right.
China continues to help North Korea and the Iranians.
Iran.
Exactly. And here we are continuing to trade with China. I mean, none of this makes any sense. It's almost like it's some kind of a war game to me.
It is kind of a little tit for tat sort of thing. The Chinese did publish a very specific work on this called Asymmetrical Warfare. And the book was published by a couple of senior colonels in their Air Force, where they noted the use of proxy wars of North Korea, Pakistan, Syria, Lebanon, others, combined with terrorist operations, and they even mentioned Al-Qaeda specifically, would be able to spread the United States and our armed forces thin so that China could carry out her regional interests, such as Taiwan. That's one of those things that we have to look back, who's pulling the strings on the puppets. When you get down to the closer tactical level, you know, like North Korea, for example, still crazy after all these years, Kim Jong-il, you know, him coming out and having the announcement that they have nuclear weapons, well, I'm sure you're shocked to find this out. You know, and I'm doing this with the old parody of Casablanca, tongue-in-cheek here, as if we really didn't know. Once again, the problem with settling the affairs in the peninsula will probably be reserved to diplomatic operations. It's been that way since the Cold War, simply because a war in that limited theater would be very devastating to South Korea. And of course, the real threat here is Japan. Tokyo does not view this with... as an amusement park. They are is certainly in the process of rearming and reestablishing their leadership roles. They are fully aware of North Korea and of China's expansionist policy.
Well, why would any country, Charles, commit suicide by launching its nuclear arsenal or one missile against anyone? Here's an example. Let's say North Korea decides they're going to launch against Japan, for lack of a country, and they send their one missile there, and they annihilate Tokyo, for instance. Now, they know, right, there's going to be a response, isn't there?
Yeah. Here's the key to, and this is, again, part of the new way of fighting. That response may not be nuclear. In particular, when you're dealing with third world tyranny, very narrow leadership operations, the response may be actually limited or directed towards their leadership. Responding and destroying Pyongyang and other major cities would kill a lot of civilians and make you feel really good, but it would not really accomplish a lot.
Well, I don't know who it would make feel good.
I'm sure the Japanese would probably feel good in a case like that, or if the North Koreans managed to put a bomb on one of their Taipodong long-range missiles, mm-hmm. say, popped one into Alaska or the American Northwest.
They could hit Los Angeles, couldn't they?
Potentially, yes. And, you know, once again, obviously eviscerating the entire country from the globe would probably be the knee-jerk response. The measured response, on the other hand, would be to use these very specialized weapon systems that we have to locate the leadership and annihilate it. Without a head, these countries suddenly become pretty much a very large mob looking to be directed, as we saw with Iraq.
I mean, are you saying that we would sustain a hit? Let's say Los Angeles, that they would take out Los Angeles. It's gone, and with it, it's millions of inhabitants, including this program, by the way, until we move. But we would take that hit and not retaliate that way?
It is a consideration because, once again, as I pointed out,
my God.
All right, if you retaliate in kind, what do? You kill 20 or 30 million innocent people.
Well, and you'd be beginning to split this planet, probably.
Right. On the other hand, if you retaliate with a precision strike mode, you take out Kim, his inner leadership, his sanctum, basically him, his pets, his front yard, his party animals, and all of the...
Well, then why don't they do that right now, then, and eliminate the potential problem?
Obviously, we might start something if we did that right now, but I think that's a deterrent factor for Kim to understand. Occasionally, these unmanned vehicles that we're going to discuss do make a purposeful appearance. A real good example from the 1970s, in the 1970s, Mao Zedong was making a rather nasty drumbeat, and I believe it was the Nixon administration had an SR-71 do an overflight of Beijing. It was my understanding it was intentionally done while Mao was sitting at tea, enjoying himself in the afternoon. The sonic boom knocked over his teacups and broke a few windows, but it sent a message. And right after that, he was suddenly and notoriously quiet for several months.
Well, and we saw what happened to Gaddafi when, during the Reagan administration, they took out one of his many castles and sadly killed one of his children and his wife.
The real target was the building next door, which took out many of his intelligence and security apparatus leaders.
But he got the message.
He got the message. He's come around, if you noticed, after watching what happened in Iran.
Sure, I don't trust him, but he has come around. I mean, I wouldn't give the guy a gun and walk in front of him.
But on the other hand, we can at least do the old Reagan-era routine, which is trust but verify.
When we come back, very briefly, let's talk about this relationship between Russia, China, and some of these rogue nations, and then us, And then let's get into the invisible aircraft, the robotic planes, and this incredible technology that's out there. And as you say, some of it could have been, you know, UFOs could have been mistaken for some of these flying machines that we have. I'll be back in a moment with our special guest, Charles R. Smith. His website, SoftWar, not where, SoftWar.net. Got a fascinating book out, by the way, called Deception. It's available at PineLakeMedia.com, Barnes & Noble as well. Back in a moment.
Want to time travel? Go back to past shows on Streamlink. Sign up online at CoastToCoastAM.com.
Softly creeping, left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone. Streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stabbed by the flash of a neon light, split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, people writing songs that voices never share. No one did.
Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And our special guest tonight, Charles R. Smith. Well, the After Dark CD, it is available to you right now. Two CDs included, 2.5 hours of bumper music. Really fascinating calls to the program, and also some ghost stories, scary ghost stories, by the way. You can order the CD by going to AfterDarkCD.com. That's right on its website, AfterDarkCD.com. Or call this toll-free number. Operators are there now. 1-800-598-2331. Did you get it? 1-800-598-2331. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Charles R. Smith. Charles, this incredible game of chess, this bizarre game where the Russians, who are supposed to now be our friends, are selling missiles to Syria, who is not our friend, who would like to take out Israel. The Chinese, who are doing things with North Koreans, who aren't our friends. Yet the Chinese, of course, you know, they're our biggest supplier of everything. This is just too weird for me. I don't understand it. Why are they all playing this game?
Well, the easiest and the most obvious answer is money. The driving factor, what makes the world go round, etc. In the case of the Chinese, it's a fairly easy explanation. Our policy with the Russians during the Cold War was not to trade with the Soviet Union for the fear of building them up and encouraging a dictatorship, a tyranny that oppressed its people, and giving them technology that they might actually shoot at us. The opposite is the case with the Chinese. The winners in the debate policy for trade with China are the free traders. These are basically major corporations who have a vested interest, essentially, in very cheap labor and the cheap goods that are produced in China to be sold in the consumer outlets here in the United States.
And I see where General Motors is building a plant in China. I think Anheuser-Busch does a lot of business with them. Most large corporations do. I mean, to me, you sit back and see this happening, going on, and I'm saying to myself, there's not going to be a war. These countries aren't going to be fighting against each other. I mean, they're just economically all tied together. There's something else afoot here, and I haven't been able to put my finger on it yet.
Well, that's the basic theory of several of the major leadership figures, that war, state-to-state war in particular with China, is not a likely event. On the other hand, there are those of us who are involved in national security who note little things like the encouragement in North Korea, the statements of General Yong Gang Kai, the number two commander of the PLA, who made it very clear that if we like Taiwan that much, we should be willing to sacrifice Los Angeles. Basically, it was a veiled threat that they would vaporize Los Angeles.
I remember that.
We got
yes.
in their way. Of course, there are not only the belligerent statements of the PLA, but their rearmament efforts are very clearly aimed at the United States and our allies in the region. So we have a rather interesting and competing political interests, actually on both sides of the lake. The Chinese army, in many cases, is the main beneficiary of this increase in trade. Many of the companies that do make a lot of money in China are actually owned and operated by the PLA for profit. A good chunk of that profit is actually funneled into the Chinese army for the acquisition of weapon systems, as well as things that I outlined in my book that appeared in the RAND Corporation report that was put together by the Commerce Department, or at least contracted during the Clinton administration, where they noted that the Chinese generals frequently take a slice of the action right off for themselves for things like parties, foreign luxury automobiles, and Swiss bank accounts.
Oh, I'm sure they're doing very well, Charles.
Well, you know, it's kind of rare that you would read a government report or a government-sponsored report where they mention Chinese generals with Swiss bank accounts. You know, the flip side of this is that despite the warlords getting their pockets lined with cash, that doesn't prevent the very same companies from selling advanced missile technology to Iran, for example. The net result, at least in this administration, has been to impose sanctions, banning these companies from trading here in the United States. China North Industries, better known as Norenco, comes to mind. Great Wall Industries and several others. And believe me, these companies, Great Wall, for example, is very notorious when they send representatives to the United States to engage in business practices. These representatives are actually Chinese Army soldiers who are here to acquire technology for the military.
Well, part of me believes that this is nothing but a huge Ponzi scheme where rich people in Russia, China, the European Union, the United States, this group of people that I've always called the Illuminati, whoever they may be, that they're just doing this and they're all making the money doing it. And maybe deep down inside they know there's not going to be a major war. There's going to be skirmishes. The little guys are going to get tightened and we're going to do that. But in terms of the players, well, we're going to just sit back and we're going to just watch this unfold, but we're going to make money, all of us. And so they're all happy. Part of me actually believes that, Charles. Am I nuts?
Well, it's not as new as you'd think. You may call it the Illuminati. I think of it as closer to a little orphan Annie with Daddy Warbucks.
Yeah, you may be right there, too. It may be one of the same.
Basically, these are industrialists who have a vested interest in little wars, and in some cases, big wars. And to them, and I, as I have noted clearly from the documentation that I obtained, thousands of pages to back up my writing, the decisions made at the corporate boardroom level are limited strictly to return on investment. They do not discuss national security. They do not discuss human rights or labor rights or whether it's going to hurt somebody. They discuss how is it going to affect our bottom line. And if it affects their bottom line, they will change their policy. And we've run into this kind of episode repeatedly where the consumer actually gets angry enough to force these corporations to change their tune. And don't think that this is just strictly limited to America.
It's all over the world.
Yes, the Soviet military-industrial complex, now the Russians, have the same problem, even worse, because their military is not in a buying mode. They don't have any cash. So they're forced to sell to foreign countries like China and Russia, China and India. And in some cases, the technology they're selling is actually against the national security of their own country.
And for all we know, they've already sold some suitcase nukes and God knows what else.
Well, suitcase nukes is a different story. And the reason why I say that is multiple. First and foremost, when you start talking about nuclear weapons, now you're talking about putting us all together in the same foxhole. Me, the industrialist, the presidents, the kings, the top generals. They don't like being in the foxholes. They prefer their diplomats to settle affairs when it gets that serious.
They'd rather you be in the foxhole.
Right. Now, that's one of the reasons why warfare has changed so radically since the invention of the atomic bomb. It sort of brought the warfare back to the leadership, okay? It said, okay, if you really get super serious, watch out. It's going to come into your lap. So that sort of put things on the topsy-turvy. Remember back in prehistoric days, the leader was the first guy out in front with the club. It's evolved to the point now where it's the guy back in the bunker. Well, being back in the bunker isn't necessarily the safest place either anymore. Now, the other half of this is nuclear weapons require an extensive chain of logistics and expertise. You got to have bucks to make them work, and you have to maintain them on a regular basis. The Russian backpack nuke, for example, has a shelf life of around 12 months, and by that I mean that's as long as it can go and be operational.
Well, why is that?
Well, there are a number of specific pieces of equipment that deteriorate rather rapidly. There's also the fissionable material, which has to be maintained in a specific quantity and quality. And after about 12 months, these things wear out. The fissionable material starts to decay rapidly, like the tritium and the initiator devices in specific. So after about 18 months, this thing is totally useless. It's a lump. The same thing applies to even our strategic arsenals and strategic weapons. And if you note, even when the Soviet Union fell, the Soviet military strategic nuclear arsenal was very closely held by highly trusted Politburo troops because the leadership knew you get one into the hands of a rebel, they can stage an election. Now, the real concern, globally speaking, by the intelligence and law enforcement is a chemical weapon. The Soviet Union did not categorize or maintain the same kind of security over the chemical weapon systems that they did with their nuclear.
Right.
And chemical weapons have a very long shelf life. Some of the versions of VX can exist on the shelf for 30 years. You just pull it out, pop the cork, and it works. Doesn't require a lot of expertise, doesn't require a lot of logistics and maintenance. You don't need an Einsteinian engineer constantly maintaining it.
Easily to be transportable.
Very easily masked, as any number of industrial chemicals. nuclear weapons give off specific gamma radiation, and there are detector systems that can be deployed at airports, at border sites, be flown on unmanned vehicles, or even patrol underwater. And we've seen this take place. A good example was about 2 years ago, a ship from Portugal was quarantined off the New Jersey coast because there was radiation detected. It turned out that it had clay pots on board that had been made in mud that had a high uranium content. But that was enough to trigger the detectors and quarantine the ship. The flip side is, you know, if I want to bring in a one-ton canister of VX, it could come in on a container ship, it could come in on a railroad car, it could be shipped across the border in a semi-trailer with a shipment of pesticides, and no one would notice.
Jeez. Well, Charles, I tell you what, I want to devote next hour to talking about this drone technology and these invisible planes that I think are being used now. But when you get a moment, if you can get up to the coasttocoastam.com website, I want you to take a look at a picture that a military person has just sent us confidentially, if you would. And you'll see it listed right under the feature story of unmanned craft. This is the link that says Air Vehicle Number 1. It may not be real. You know, it could be a hoax. Snopes says it is, but I want you to look at it as a professional. Tell me what you think it is. You know, it's a bizarre looking plane, but again, it may be just a hoax. Somebody may have planted it on a picture of an aircraft carrier. So can you look at that, and we'll talk about that when we come back?
All right. Well, I'll pull out the old laptop and link it up to the other line. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, you'll see it, and just take a look at it. That'll be interesting indeed. Now, are we not using invisible planes, robotic planes now, drones, not only in Iraq, but possibly spying over Iran as well?
We're using them in a number of places, Iraq, Iran. We're actually flying them over the United States. They're in international territories as well as over North Korea, and in some cases probably penetrating airspace in Russia and China.
How big are these craft? Because is it possible that a lot of people in this country have seen them and they think, oh my gosh, it's a UFO?
They can range in size from very small, and by very small I mean the latest deployed systems that are currently being evaluated by the Marines are about 11 inches, to very large. One of the unmanned aircraft was probably about the same size as a 737. So we have a number of covert and highly classified systems. Most of the sizes range about right around the Cessna, a small plane size. But there is a wide variety of systems depending on which mission you want to select. The miniature UAVs or miniature UCAV, which is unmanned aerial vehicles or unmanned combat aerial vehicles, you're looking at about bird size. These can be launched by individual units. Then their missions range from assassination to covert surveillance.
Why are we using these instead of a manned plane, Jack?
A couple of reasons. First and foremost, there's no Francis Gary Powers if one gets shut down.
Right.
Second, without a man inside, these aircraft can have extremely long endurance, much longer than a human being could possibly withstand. You don't have to carry oxygen. You don't have to carry the facilities to keep a person alive. So you can dedicate the payload to either more range or more fuel or more electronics and capabilities. Third, of course, these aircraft are flying in hostile airspaces in many cases, areas where you would not want a person because they could very easily get killed. We have lost a number of these aircraft as well, but, you know, the flip side to that is much better to lose a piece of unmanned robot than, again, be viewing a captured or dead pilot on a major media outlet with an outraged leadership.
Wasn't it a drone plane that took out a group of people in Afghanistan that they thought might have been Osama bin Laden and some of his cronies?
Yes, the Predator A has been used several times offensively. They tested it originally. Predator was originally a CIA system. The Air Force took it on and said, look, we think we can arm this thing. So they put Hellfire laser-guided missiles underneath, experimented with it a couple of times, and then went ahead and deployed it in Afghanistan, in Iraq. It has flown over Yemen as well. And it has been quite successful at targeting and taking out specific individuals or specific targets. One of the reasons for that is that you may have something under surveillance, but it may take 10 or 20 minutes for a manned craft with weapon systems to get there. And obviously having weapons on the unmanned vehicle itself make a lot of difference. You can just go ahead and say, all right, we'll take care of it. And that has happened. At this point, we haven't taken out Osama bin Laden, but believe me, the closest video, the last independent video of Osama bin Laden, appears to have been taken by an unarmed Predator, which was patrolling over Afghanistan.
Well, okay. Well, take a look at that picture if you can. Let's come right back. I think it's probably a great piece of computer animation. I don't think that's a real plane. I think it's probably some toy model again. It is incredible what people can do with their computers now. But take a look at it, because maybe it's a model of what very well is a real plane. If you would, Charles, we'll talk a little bit about that. And the rest, of course, of the drone and invisible plane technology, there's a program called Senior Prom. Tell me what that's all about when we come back as well. I'm George Norrie. Our guest tonight, Charles R. Smith.
Subscribe to After Dark. Call toll-free 1-888-727-5505.
Thank you.